Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy Newell-Tareen, editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to welcome our guest for today's episode, Kate Ross, co-founder and CEO of A104. Welcome, Kate. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Thanks very much for having me on.
Great to have you. Thanks for joining us. And I'm also here with ExchangeWire CEO Rachel Smith. Good to have you here, Rachel. How's your week going?
Very well, thank you, Amy. Delighted to be joining the podcast again. Feels like I've had a little bit of a break from it, so it's nice to get back into the podcast hot seat.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had you. Good to have you back. So today we've got a bit of an AI special. We're looking at three big stories about AI, covering the use of AI in streaming, Meta showing resistance to signing the EU's AI code of practice, and a new UK AI audit standard on the horizon. So for our first story, The Guardian reports that for the first time ever, Netflix has used AI in one of its shows, in a move which the streaming giant says will allow it to make films and shows cheaper and of better quality. It was used for The Eternaut, an Argentinian science fiction series, and the sequence which AI was used for was said to have been completed 10 times faster than it could have been completed with traditional special effects, tools and workflows, and at a much lower production cost than is typical for a show like that. So, Kate, I'll come to you first here. Do you think there's any risk of the cinema landscape becoming populated with AI slop like we're seeing in a lot of other places?
No, sure. I think cinema and TV is populated with a lot of human slop. So I'm not personally that fussed about the sort of the quality angle. But I think that is the AI slop piece is almost, it's probably more relevant to the more sort of democratized sort of distribution channels like social and things like that, where people can very easily sort of create a lot of content now and push that out. And obviously that's my world, social and content. So I am unnerved there. From a distribution perspective and cinema and TV, those channels are still pretty guardly, guarded, they're gatekeeped. So it doesn't feel like an AI slop piece. For me, when I look at the technology, it feels quite exciting because it's just allowing economically, which wasn't possible before. And there's a democratization angle there, which is really exciting, which has been happening for decades. Didn't happen with AI. It happened with us all suddenly having video cameras in our phones. I mean, that's been a process that's been ongoing. And I do feel like less of a collapsing of visual quality. It'll just enable more visual quality and become more entertaining. And it's really critical as well within the TV and cinema landscape, where they're constantly pressured to retain attention of consumers when social and digital, is continually pressing against those. So I think it's a great opportunity for them to really sort of stretch themselves and push higher quality content, more entertaining content, more attention-grabbing content. So that's where I'd be around the AI slot piece.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it opens a lot of opportunities for new players to kind of do things at a lower cost and, get their foot in the door. Rachel, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with Kate regarding, the sort of the direction of some of the content that we consume in a general sense anyway. You know, I was on my train on the way into the office this morning, and I was standing up and I wasn't prying, but I could happen to see over the shoulder of the passenger that was sat in the seat that was near me, and he was watching, what's it called, Below Deck or something like that. I'm only guessing because, I just could sort of broadly see what was going on. And I was thinking, wow, you're so keen on Below Deck that you're watching it at 7:30 in the morning on the way to work. Like, it made me think about the concept of the slop that we consume. I'm using air quotes here. So I think we're doing that no matter what. I don't think AI is helping us do that any more or, frankly, any less. I think that is just a natural human consumption point. We kind of gravitate towards addictive junk and we have to work quite hard to row ourselves back from that. I know there's an argument that if the junk wasn't made, we wouldn't be consuming it, but the same goes for McDonald's and junk food and all the rest of it. So who knows, maybe in a broader sense, we'll start to see a move away from that kind of low quality TV. I'm not saying Below Deck's low quality either, because I'm sure lots of readers are big fans. But the wider point though, I think, and picking up on some of the things that Kate said, is that this is more exciting than alarming in my opinion. If we think about, if we think about things that have changed in cinema in our lifetime. I can still remember the early days of computer animation and people being really concerned that that was somehow sort of substandard and sub-quality to, you know, either old forms of animation or creating other, because computer animation used to be mostly focused on creating children's content. And so the argument was, well, we should be doing some kind of manual animation, or we should just be creating different types of content that doesn't involve computed animation, and it should involve live actors and all the rest of it. But you think of how that has just changed cinema beyond belief. It's no longer just about animation. It also then bled into this entire CGI world of being able to create images and things that we couldn't do in person. And it's actually broadened and widened the creative scope rather than narrowing it. So I think the first thing I thought is that as long as that's in the hands of people that are truly creative and have got a job, you know, that means that they need to create the most amazing things possible that stretch beyond our imaginations, then in the context of creating entertaining content, that's really exciting. And Netflix were really clear about the context in which this was used, which was to evidently automate things and produce things that couldn't have been done at the same speed or the same at the same cost either. And I think that's a really important point, because we constantly say the benefits of AI will be that it will make things more efficient and less time consuming. And we need to give a nod to that. You know, that's exactly what happened in the world of animation. Computer animation came in not to supersede what manual animation could do, but to take that concept and the beauty of it and scale it up. And, you know, I have a little bit of insight into that because a good friend of mine that I went to university with studied industrial design and became a computer animator, and to this very day still runs one of the really big animation studios out in Australia. And I can remember him, the early days of him showing me how they animated, cinematic content. And it was really detailed and involved. It was just a lot faster than you could do it manually, but you still needed to be a craftsperson in order to be able to pull that off. And I'd like to think that that will be the same for the way that AI is used and applied in the context of creating fantastic content. Actually, you still need to be a craft person. You still need to have the human creativity to make it sing and to make it do things that amaze us.
I totally agree. Was it Steve Jobs who said the most powerful person in the world is a storyteller? And the storytelling, like, you can have the best AI effects. If the story is CRAP, then literally you are just, people will turn off. It doesn't matter. It should augment it. It should make it sing even more than it does. But the basis of that song will be about human storytelling. I remember it was a couple of years ago, I think, and someone uploaded, it was such a good example. Someone asked ChatGPT, tell us about the birth of your first child. And it did this whole little, like, you know, story anecdote about the birth of its first child. It was things like, I'd never felt love like this before. The sun was streaming in the window. And then this guy wrote about the birth of his first child with his wife. And he was like, I'm sitting next to a blinking vending machine and I'm terrified my wife is about to die. And even though I'm just talking about this now, and it still makes me feel emotional, because this is an actual human telling an actual real human story, not AI, which is like, it was lovely. No, it's not. It's scary. You know, it's so layered and differentiated human experience, and the resonance we get from a human telling their experience of something else and trying to make a connection. And that's all art, isn't it? You know, again, another great quote, art is a hand reaching out and you going to hold that hand. It's that human resonance between human experience. So I Netflix saying, and I want to talk about the job loss stuff obviously in a minute, because this is what comes straight in, doesn't it, when you start talking about this automation. But the other thing, I think I posted something on LinkedIn the other day talking about how I believe the advertising industry is still a fantastic place to work, even with all of the tech bros telling, you know, everybody in my company and everybody coming through the pipeline that there's no jobs, it's all going to be automated. I fundamentally disagree with that. I think that some tasks might be automated, but I don't see the entire thing being automated. Anyway, and for this LinkedIn post, defense of the industry, I used an AI image because economically I could, within 3 seconds, generate a really cute, fun image which represent the 4 junior hires we were making across the company. And I got so much flack. And fair enough, you know, you post on LinkedIn, you know, you got to expect, you know, debate, that's fine. But I got loads of flack for using the AI image, because you're saying you're trying to defend the industry against AI. But that AI image has ripped off all the artists and creators, to your point, Rachel, about you know, these motion people, they've done all this work. AI has then got in, the tools are going in, they're training on all this. And that ethical piece, and that's, I know, a whole other topic. But I think whenever we talk about automation with the creativity, LLMs have literally gone and taken creative, human creative work in order to then output these things. And so I think it's a really complex ethical dilemma, specifically around AI within creative spaces. And I, you know, we said we're going to talk about AI auditing and stuff later, but from what came out of the US yesterday with President Trump, you know, that is, they are hurling down, we just don't care. It is just unlucky. Do you know what I mean? They've got it. It's fair use, et cetera. So I don't know what you guys think about that. You know, and again, Rachel, with your contacts in the creative space, do you know what I mean? That sort of that ethical unfairness that a lot of people are feeling in the creative space right now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a huge issue. Again, I think about perhaps the early days of music going from analog channels to digital channels, and that was an enormous. And in fact, who was I talking? I was talking with somebody about this the other day. Because we were talking about Pandora apparently becoming a really popular streaming platform. Again, it was one of the first legitimate streaming platforms for music after Napster sort of rose to fame and then collapsed, because the business model for Napster was actually ripping artists off and allowing people to download music illegally. And of course, eventually, obviously, it had a legitimate business model. But prior to that, that's what it was. And I can remember that inflection point of everyone saying, this is completely immoral because you are ripping artists off. You know, we used to go to a record store and purchase records, and we knew where the money went. And now we there wasn't even a route to purchase at that time online. The whole idea was sort of a bit like Spotify, loaning the, you know, the rights to be able to listen to the music, but you could never actually download it and own it. And now here we are in a modern world where we just accept that that is, and so do artists accept that's part of the contract. But there are different ways that artists can make money from those streaming rights and from owning the IP of their creative their creative output. So I do agree that that's a huge issue. It's a moral dilemma, and we're absolutely at an inflection point, and there's lots of risks, inbuilt risks into the world that we live in at the moment that could mean that it could all head down completely the wrong path. So we are going to have to work hard as a society and as a group of professionals within our industry to make sure that IP is protected and that people get appropriately compensated for the things that they create. But the other side of that coin is exactly what you mentioned earlier on, Kate, and it is the democratization of being able to create something that's wonderful and that's beyond the expectations or the limits that you would have had without these tools, and then being able to, you know, make a living off of that, right? So, it's a fine line, and we're still absolutely finding our way. I mean, you know, I think the work thing's really important. Amy's probably going to bring us on to that. But, I saw a quote recently that said, AI is not going to take your job, but somebody that knows how to use AI tools will take your job if you don't learn how to use those AI tools yourself. So, you know, that's another way of looking at this as well, I think.
my updated quote on that is always says, like, AI won't take your job, but it will tell your boss that you think it should. And that's what you have to defend against, as in the narratives in the market are that you're going to be put in significant pressure. We see this everywhere. We see this from an agency perspective and a client perspective in the market, that there is an extraordinary powerful, you know, obviously most best funded technology engine ever, LLMs. And there is extraordinary VC backed hype machine, which needs to talk about job loss narratives to justify the extraordinary spend on training these tools. And so those job loss narratives mean that very senior C-suite level are engaging in technology in many ways that they have never before, or certainly automation technology, because automation technology has been around for decades. We've been automating stuff forever. Washing machines, tractor, you know, we've been doing this forever. But suddenly there's this like newfound like hunger for technical automation via AI or LLMs. Obviously, we're speaking about a very specific part of AI right here, LLMs technology. And that is causing this top-down pressure of people who don't understand actually what people are doing day to day in their, let's go, white-collar roles. They don't understand the detail and the complexity, because most modern jobs are really, really complex, because otherwise they've already been automated. And I say this all the time, like, The tractor was the biggest job destroying technology ever invented. It destroyed 30% of US livelihoods with its invention. And that was 100 years ago now. Anyway, but that was because it replaced a singular repetitive task. Hand plowing is doing this up and down in lines. And I'm like, is anyone sat in an office right now tapping a spacebar? Because that is the equivalent of the complexity of the task that was automated. My role, I know your roles, my role right now is there is no singular repetitive task in sight. It is constant. I am in about maybe a couple of hundred separate conversations in a day across multiple people, making maybe 1,000 decisions a day. You know, the complexity of it is extraordinary. It is absolutely not going to be replaced by agentic AI without even getting onto the compounding hallucination rates within. I saw a great article yesterday, which was, you know, it's obviously hallucination rates are a problem with LLMs. And it's something like, even if you work to an 80% correction, you know, correct sort of output from an LLM in terms of things, if you then compound it, because agentic AI is just compounding AI decisions within, you know, something like within nine steps, you've got to 10% correct. And so, yeah, you know, like you're just compounding the hallucination problem with an agentic AI. Anyway, yeah, that's a whole other topic. But yeah, so I think that top-down cost-cutting pressure is really, really difficult. So my advice to everyone is always like, you need to really, really be clear about what your job is and where the complexities are and get clear on actually, can any of this be automated with AI or actually with any other technology, and yeah, be on the front foot to do that yourself and to advocate that yourself. So you defend that broader wholesale role you have, because people are making a lot of unthinking, I think, decisions around this, that they can replace humans wholesale, which I don't think is correct. Tasks within someone's job, maybe. Wholesale human, probably not.
Exactly like when computers were first invented and made their way into the workforce. That must have been extremely, you know, confronting for a lot of people that were working at the time. I mean, if anyone was a Mad Men friend in, you know, a Mad Men friend, Mad Men fan in the early days of that series, I remember really vividly the episode where they introduced the IBM computer and it was kind, yeah, of wheeled. It was this massive, enormous thing that was wheeled into the office and sat in its own room doing stuff. And people walked past it on a daily basis and nobody understood what it did. And everyone looked at it kind of with their heads cocked to the side, like, how curious, what is that? And people started saying, you know, the talk is that that's going to replace some of the work that we do. And people just couldn't wrap their heads around it. And, you know, when was Mad Men set? Late 50s, early 60s, mid 60s. It's a bit like that, you know. And yes, the computer did replace a lot of people's jobs. Again, I'm using air quotes, because what it did was automate tasks that were otherwise very manual. It also upskilled us all. You know, we can all type for ourselves these days. So there's no longer a typing pool, but we all do it for ourselves. Yeah. And that's a good thing. You know, I can remember my mother teaching me how to type when I was a student by just saying, this is really important. It's just digital writing and you'll need to do it your whole life. So mm-hmm. let me show you how to do it. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that AI, there is a threat to tasks more than roles and people. And we are definitely, again, at an inflection point where we need to understand how all of that unfolds. And so, therefore, we need to understand the best ways to write, you know, to create job descriptions that explain what people are going to be doing in their daily life, what tasks to hand over to an AI tool. And I'm actually, you're not handing it over to an AI tool, but what tasks are you going to use AI tools to do better? Mm. And what stuff, you know, you really need the people in your organization to be focused on. And there's, you know, there's never going to be a day where we don't need humans to make all of this work, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I think we can all agree that AI probably won't be taking people's jobs in the cinema sector in the future, but maybe people that know how to use these new technologies will be.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think, and it's really interesting just to put on that, because I think the job loss narratives are so powerful going around right now. There is still no statistically significant data that's been seen in two independent studies from Chicago, University of Chicago, University of Stanford, undertaken this year. They still can't see any changes in jobs data. And again, I always keep an eye on the US job data information coming out. May and June came out just a couple of weeks ago. And jobs are holding steady or growing. The only area that jobs have shrunk is in the government in the US because of DOGE. So the idea that people are screaming about job loss narratives around AI is actually, no, it's actually Elon Musk, not an AI, just in a different, role is causing job losses. And we don't know where that will go. And I think the shape of work will change. But the shape of work, as you were saying, typing sleeping pools. I mean, it's crazy to think, isn't it? Or that, yeah, someone would come in and sit and listen to you and then go and type up the notes. I even think, like, from my early career, like, you know, account execs, yeah, would be writing notes or, like, making tea. The idea that you would have people paying people just to do that role, and that's only like 10, 15 years ago, and that's crazy nowadays, isn't it? That's just not something you'd be investing 100%. In.
I mean, I think sort of one more point on this as well is that, you know, what feeds into the fear is, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg coming out saying, we're just going to be using AI from now on to, you know, to muster up creatives for ads, to deliver the ads, the agencies aren't going to be needed, creative people aren't going to be needed. And I just think at the moment that just demonstrates how little he understands about the advertising world. And I think he would probably feel proud of someone saying that about him, because he's always been very clear that he doesn't really want to have anything to do with advertising. He's always wanted to distance himself from that. So therefore, he doesn't really understand what it involves. And he may well be building his business around how AI can replace lots of things that we do. But let's just see what that actually looks like. Yeah. Because I agree with you, Kate. It's not the wheels of change aren't fast. And I personally don't believe that will be possible. I believe that you will still, again, if all you're doing is creating shitty creatives and placing shitty ads, then you're going to get shitty outcomes. If actually what you want to do is, as a brand, develop a relationship with your consumers, because you need to understand what kind of products that you can market to them, and you need to get feedback from those customers, and you need to find ways to find them and to get messages in front of them, then your advertising sort of offering and your marketing offering has all of a sudden become way more complex. Yeah. And that can't just be outsourced to an agenda AI tool. That's going to require lots of human capital and thought and effort, and and the creative element even more than anything else. So totally. We might be able to speed up some of those things, which will be super important. But even just being able to write the prompts, if you were going to get an LLM to create an ad for you, even just being able to write the prompts that produce a good quality ad means that you really need to know all of that other stuff first before you can get to that place. Therefore, there will still be a role for agencies. There will still be a role for anyone that can help brands do that.
I completely agree. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the landscape, the media landscape is more complex than it has ever been. It's certainly over the 16 years of running A4, like I look back at Hallison days of the noughties and the tens in terms of how simple it looks, looking back at where things were. So I think agencies as consultants, I mean, agencies are always having the bottom part of their business, asset delivery, like we all are, eaten away. Do you know what I mean? Because of technological automation, it's happening all the time. So you've always got to be moving up that food chain from a consultancy perspective. So I totally agree. And like right now, like from a Meta perspective, you interface with these platforms, they have like a one-click setup and it's dreadful. But then perversely, if you then go and do it manually, which we do because we don't believe in AI running this stuff, you do it manually and it takes an hour just to turn off all the AI features they're trying to turn on for you. I completely agree. It's a complete misunderstanding of how this stuff works. There's an arrogance to it too. The idea that you can put money into Meta and money comes out. The idea that Meta is the singular most all-important influence of consumer behavior and purchasing decisions is balmy. Like, that he thinks he has that much control over global consumer purchasing journeys. That's blatantly incorrect. Yeah. I think the singular thing it will do will, again, back to the thing we're talking about, democratization. It will allow smaller players who can't afford agencies and it doesn't make economic sense to take on with smaller budgets to gain access to technology that maybe they were nervous about getting in front of, they didn't understand. This will give them that access for them to go and, to go and try with it. So I feel like it's a long tail small business play. I think Meta are making, I think Zuckerbergs make those headlines because they're sexy and the media irritatingly laps them up and plasters them everywhere, which is always frustrating because agencies are always just having to prove their value. And it's like, really, guys, seriously? And what really annoys me about it is that agencies have literally been salespeople for these platforms the last 15 years. And I'm quite in shock, actually, at how poorly platforms have turned around the last 12, 24 months and have turned on the very people who sold this and educated for free clients on this technology and these platforms and digital journeys, and then turn around and say, you don't need them anymore. And I think they will come to rue it because the agency, regardless of what you think of agencies, we're powerful communicators, we're phenomenal storytellers, and we are pissed. And I certainly, from our perspective, we have the relationships now with those platforms, agencies are feeling really, really burnt and are feeling really let down. And I think that they're going to see this in the market, do you know what I mean, in the coming years as we turn away from them and go, actually, you know what? black boxing all your spend with Meta. Mental, crazy.
Yeah,
this
totally.
Guy doesn't care about you. We do actually care about you. He doesn't. He's just going to take your cash and run.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a cutthroat world of business. Sorry, Amy. Yeah.
Sorry, it's we're such, I mean, you could just go in 100 different session. Routes, couldn't you? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, like you said, Kate, it would be good for the smaller players in the market. But yeah, the human element is so necessary, really, you know, if you want to do advertising well, for sure. So now moving on to our next story from TechCrunch. Meta is refusing to sign the EU's AI Code of Practice. So a bit related, I guess, moving on from our conversation there with Meta. The code is a voluntary framework which aims to help companies implement processes and systems to comply with the bloc's legislation for regulating AI. It requires companies to provide and regularly update documentation about their AI tools and services and bans developers from training AI on pirated content. It also obligates companies to comply with content owners' requests to not use their works in their datasets. So Meta's Chief Global Affairs Officer, Joel Kaplan, wrote on LinkedIn, "Europe is heading down the wrong path on AI. We've carefully reviewed the European Commission's Code of Practice for General Purpose AI Models, and Meta won't be signing it. This code introduces a number of legal uncertainties for model developers, as well as measures which go far beyond the scope of the AI Act." He stated that this overreach will throttle the development and deployment of frontier AI models in Europe and stunt European companies looking to build businesses on top of them. Kate, what do you make of Meta's stance on the EU's code of practice?
Very unsurprising. Just, I mean, the very cultural DNA of Meta. I mean, that infamous early mantra they had, which is move fast and break things. Zuckerberg has never cared about breaking things. And that founder, he's obviously a very strong, virulent founder, sat within that organization still. This is completely expected. You know, they push back on GDPR. They push back on the Digital Services Act. They do eventually comply when they're forced to, but they are always the ones kicking up a fuss. You'll have... I think it's been really interesting actually to watch the interplay between the different sort of large platforms. Microsoft obviously have signed and they're pitching themselves as that responsible AI leader. They're so in with enterprise. They know that enterprise needs consistency. It needs governance. It needs slow thinking. So I think position themselves as the grown up in the room in this debate, I think has been a really interesting position. And then OpenAI too have signed. Sam Altman, he makes me laugh. He tries to sort of position about a bit semi-religious, doesn't he? You know the way, like a bit of a pastor vibe. Like he'll be on a panel, he like whispers his truths. So strange. So he's always one of looking like the good guy. You know, like, oh, I'm above all this sort of thing, which he is absolutely not. He's in Saudi, you know, a few weeks ago trying to raise money. Like he is not above this commercial game. So yeah, I think the interplay is really interesting. I'm not surprised what Meta are doing. I think Microsoft and OpenAI are clearly trying to keep the EU on side, which will give them obviously more influence in the final terms. Because obviously this is all just a dress rehearsal for the AI Act in 2026, which is going to be formal law. And I thought it was interesting, Microsoft's statement as well, they did directly thank the EU for engaging with the industry. So you can sort of see their play quite, you know, nakedly there, which is like, we'll play ball if you keep engaging with us, whereas Meta are doing this sort of classic toys out the pram thing. So that was, yeah, I wasn't very surprised in short.
Yeah. Rachel, do you think we should be worried to see this kind of reaction against the rules that the EU is trying to set here?
I think similarly to Kate's perspective, because it's not surprising, I completely agree, then... In short answer to your question, Amy, yes, we should be worried insofar as businesses like Meta will do whatever they need to do for their own financial and commercial gain. And so, you know, all of the morality issues that we just raised in discussion of the earlier story are still relevant to this, right? They don't want to be tied to any legislative code unless they're forced to. Now, in part, that's become just, you know, their operational status quo, right? Which is legislation on one side of the barrier and them as an entity on the other. They've got no interest in complying with anything unless they are absolutely required to do so. There is something else here, though, I think, about running a big grown-up business, which is that you don't, you know, typically speaking, if you're a big multinational corporation, you are very careful about siding with government on anything because it could come back to bite you at some stage. So there could be some, you know, unintended consequences or some, you know, underrated risks. And that will be probably the first move that they've been advised by their own legal counsel to do, which would be, listen, if you're not required to interact with this, then do nothing for now. That's the safest bet. So there'll be that. But it will be mostly because as an entity in an organisation, like Kate said, they've got a founder who's extraordinarily arrogant and thinks that he can, you know, carry on doing what he's always done, which is run things the way that he wants to run things. So should we be concerned about that? Yeah, I think we should. Hopefully there is enough now baked into our global economy that will balance that out. There are other actors and other players. Again, as Kate mentioned, some of them might be just as potentially difficult to work with or to navigate our way around as Meta is, but it certainly makes things a little more interesting, right? And I think one of the reasons that, apart from OpenAI being the business that it is and being led and run the way that it is, I think one of the reasons that Microsoft and OpenAI are engaging is because Microsoft is often given as a really good example of a multinational corporation that was tripped up by legislation back in the late 80s, early 90s with anti-competition legislation coming down the line. And they made some significant changes to their business model to accommodate the legal recommendations that were brought forward as a result of that so that they could avoid any further, legal complaints and, you know, stop spending lots of money, no doubt, on trying to hear and address those complaints. So I think they've learned from experience and they know that one way forward is to engage with lawmakers in at least an informal way along the way as part of the process. The other thing that I thought reading this story is that I think for the time being, from an advertising and marketing industry point of view, we really need to rest and lean on our industry bodies and industry associations to lead the charge here, because I think those are the organisations that can get big tech companies to come to the table and discuss issues and challenges concerning this, because they've already had some success in doing that around technical standards for advertising and marketing. So I think there's an opportunity there to kind of convert this AI code of practice conversation to a, and what impact does it have on technical standards and technical operational issues relating to marketing and advertising. And that's where you will be able to get representatives from Meta and representatives of Google much more engaged in the conversation. And let's leave the lawmaking to the legislators for now, because this will have real teeth. As Kate mentions, it's a prelude for the introduction of the AI Act, and the EU has shown time and time again that they also are willing to play ball at the same level as the likes of Mark Zuckerberg. So they will use the full force of legislative control to press forward with what they think is important.
I think it's fascinating, isn't it? Because at some level, it's a voluntary framework. Meta is saying no, it's unsurprising. But actually, what's going on here is the beginning of a very big war, which is in the context of the war of digital technology being regulated at all. Brad Smith, Microsoft president, he's spoken really powerfully, I think, in the last few years around this. Has been a really sort of, for me, a very sort of grown-up voice in the room about, you know, no technology in human history has gone unregulated for as long as digital technology has. And we know, and I guess we're waking up in the last few years, certainly, to the absolute mess that it's created by lack of that regulation. Social media and kids, you know, unprecedented sort of child and sexual exploitation online, you know, kids watching pornography, all these horrible, terrible outcomes of a completely unregulated industry, which, as you said, Rachel, is just chasing scale, it's just chasing money. And so I think, and to watch the EU come back with teeth, just as you say, has been one of the few organisations who've actually stood up to this in a meaningful way. Because self-regulation just does not work. It has not worked for 20 years.
And, you know, the EU have got political clout, right? They've got some really serious politicians that are that really want to get ahead of this. So yeah. I would say don't underestimate them. And you raise a really good point about the lack of regulation in digital industries over our lifetime. And I think of the early days of working in ad tech and marketing tech. For me, that was about 15 years ago. And I was always, having come from a government background, I was always astounded at the degree to which everyone in the industry arrogantly assumed that legislators would never really be that interested because they didn't get it and they didn't understand it. They were not wrong about about the fact that legislators didn't get it and didn't understand it. You can still argue that to a large extent. But governments legislate against millions and millions of things that they don't understand very well. That's not going to stop them legislating against it. That is their job. So, you know, that's what we're starting to see, is an environment where legislation is coming from all sorts of different directions to try to contain and control what's happening in the digital economy. Lots of people will, you know, will also use arguments such as, oh, it's, you know, we're trying to close the gate before the horse is bolted, blah, blah. But I don't really believe that. I think that at the end of the day, you know, as a society, again, you know, we are genuinely trying to get our heads around how these digital tools need to be contained and controlled and used to the benefit of society. We're still a long way from cracking that, but this is part and parcel of it, I think. And you know, we definitely need to be, legislators definitely need to be taking the stance of, you know, we need large multinational corporations and businesses of all sizes, for that matter, to take their responsibilities seriously. And if actually you're going to put your commercial gain ahead of law, then we're going to put law in the way to make sure that you can't only do that. And I think that's the right thing.
And that law has got to be so strong, haven't you, in a world in which, you know, Altman's accusing Meta of trying to steal members of his team with $100 million sign-on bonuses. Like, this is the craziness and the sort of velocity and ambition with which this is moving. We have to have such a substantive regulatory response to that, because it is it is unleashed. It is so powerful, this wave. And oh God, wouldn't it be amazing if we could actually learn the lessons of the last 20 years and meaningfully, you know, regulate this next wave of technology? I am unnerved by the amount of money, you know, slushing around this, because money often wins, and it's quite scary. But, you know, absolute kudos to the EU again for being the sort of the one really global government body that's really taking a stand against this, as opposed to, again, what's just come out of the US in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to see the government stepping in to make positive regulations here. So that moves us on to our last story quite nicely. So the UK's national standards body is set to unveil a new standard for companies that independently audit AI models, with the aim of weeding out rogue players in the growing AI verification market. The standard, which is due to be launched on 31st of July, is the first international set of requirements to standardise how assurance firms check whether companies are following AI management standards. So the British Standards Institution has warned that hundreds of unchecked groups offer audits, claiming to assess whether companies using AI models work reliably, fairly and safely. Reportedly, many of the companies that sell AI audits also develop their own AI technologies, which raises considerable concerns. Rachel, how serious are the concerns this raises? What do you think?
I think what's quite interesting about this is it's made me think a little bit more about the sort of principles of auditing, which of course are grounded in things like transparency and independence. And actually, you know, I didn't realise this until, you know, delving into the story in a little bit more depth, that most of the models that auditors use are actually black box techniques within themselves. And, you know, they've obviously got a methodology, and they query models and how those models are set up and operated and what, you know, what data they're trained on, etc. But they are, the methodology isn't necessarily transparent. So I think it's, I think having some kind of standards will perhaps help unpick an element of the industry that is a little bit currently a little bit less transparent and independent than it should be. So I think that's super interesting. I think that, again, this bleeds into the two previous stories, which is it's firmly in the wheelhouse of regulation pointed at emerging AI technologies. So I think it's important. But again, one of the questions I had when I was going through this is, how enforceable will it be? We're talking about, a standard which by definition requires people to sign up to that. So this is going to be unlike something that's legislatively enforced. it's not going to be something that's broadly implemented unless you've got sort of industry buy-in and collaboration on it. So I think it's important. I think it's sort of exposed an element of auditing function that I hadn't really appreciated fully. So I definitely think that there needs to be more independence and transparency injected into into the process of auditing, and this is a good step in that process. But I just wonder how well it will be implemented, because it will depend on getting buy-in from relevant stakeholders, and that can be complex in itself.
Yeah, definitely. Kate, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, totally agree with Rachel. I think it's an important step, necessary step, isn't it, to shine a light on this and to ask the question, to make companies ask the question, whether that be the vendors, whether it be the people they're being sold to. Like it brings up the conversation in the room, which I think is really important. Again, how strong is it? Like, does this just slip into that? You know, those procurement exercises where there's, can you please upload your 15 policies, and people upload Word documents, and are they ever tested? Are they ever shaken down? Do you know what I mean? Like, how meaningful is this in terms of outcome? But it's better than nothing, I think. And to be honest, in this absolute wild west of regulation at the moment, it's something. And I think it's a great, from a UK perspective, you know, it's trying to showcase some governance leadership. I think it's actually the first sort of like global, governance piece, you know, sort of process that's been implemented, which is actually quite horrifying since we've had the technology for nearly 2.5 years now in the mainstream. I think obviously UK broadly is going quite light touch on the regulation. It's a little bit toothless maybe, but it is the opposite of what, as I referenced earlier, the US is doing. The summit itself was called Winning the AI Race. If you needed to understand what these three executive orders and this national AI action plan, what the feeling and, you know, the intention of this is, it's an arms war. This is not thoughtful. It's not trying to think about the good of society. And it wasn't winning AI for humanity or anything. It was winning the AI race. All that matters is winning, which is about money, and it's about scale, and everything else needs to get out of the way.
I think the other important point about that you just mentioned too, Kate, is this particular standard is a piece of governance, right? It's part of a governance framework. And if you're not going to apply appropriate governance principles to industries, then you can expect those industries to break down and crumble fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So you're right. What's happened in the US is super alarming, but also not surprising because we have a lunatic in charge over there. But look to see what's happened in the time that he has been in charge. His fellow lieutenant lunatics are, up to such crazy shenanigans and behaviours that it's been handbags at dawn, not routinely across the piece, but I'm talking about his relationship with Elon Musk here. We're all really worried about where that was going to go, and now the two of them can't bear each other. So there's an argument to suggest that if all you're going to do is implement chaos in a race to win something, if you're not going to adhere to any kind of controls and to any kind of governance framework, you can expect that eventually to break down. So the idea that here in the UK, whilst it might be light touch, that's what we're trying to do, it's better than not trying to do anything at all. You know, I always think about, you're right, you don't want to go too far. You don't want it to become unnecessary administration, and you also need it to be meaningful, which is why you should be engaging with the industry to make sure that you're making it as relevant as possible and something that people feel is worth doing and that you can buy into. But I always, the sort of argument that I use to back up this perspective in general on governance, the importance of it and how it pertains to professionalising an industry is, again, my time working in the government sector. We used to, you know, organisations that I worked in had a legislative requirement, a statutory requirement to produce risk registers. And the risk register would have on it everything that was going to be a significant risk to the business that you were delivering. And the business that the organisations I was working for were delivering were, you know, critical public services. So it would be, what will happen if we can't collect the bins? What will happen if we, if we can no longer offer social housing? What will happen if all the schools need to shut down? You know, what will happen if our social care team can't make visits to, you know, kids in care anymore? Those sorts of things. And whilst all of that might seem really sort of bureaucratic and administrative, it was a really, really understandable risk register. And at the very top of it, I'll never forget this, at the very top of it, there were really practical things in place. And one of them, there was the three top risks to delivering any of these services in a place like London were things like a terrorist attack, some sort of mass flooding event that meant that you couldn't get around the streets of parts of London or whatever. And number three was a pandemic, a flu pandemic. And this was like 25 years ago when I was working in this organisation. And I remember reading these risks thinking, what's the likelihood of that? And one of the people I was working with at the time was responsible for running public health in the local authority area that I was working in. And I remember asking her, she was the director of public health, and I said, what do you think the risks of a flu pandemic are? And she looked me straight in the eye and she said, it'll happen in our lifetime. And it did. And when it did, of course, these were the organisations that actually had on a piece of paper somewhere that had to be reviewed by law every 12 months and submitted to an independent body, they had a plan of what to do in the instance that something like that happened. And so I always use that as an example. You know, we can't all predict the next pandemic and we used to spend like an hour and a half reviewing this every quarter or something like that. We don't all have the staff resources to do something like that, but we should be thinking about governance and how to professionalise our industry because it's worth the time and effort.
Totally. It has such a bad name, does it, governance? And it's literally what makes the world go around.
Totally.
And look at that Brad Smith interview I was looking at. He said, and this is, you know, a techie guy, and he's like, if you hate governance, you're going to really hate a world without it because it's like, you don't even, you know. and then you've given me, I think that's fascinating. I mean, that gives me actually some sort of hope, actually, that actually the lack of governance isn't just that, you know, late stage capitalism and all this wins. Actually, there has to be a pushback because it just doesn't work. And the best things happen with the right balance of ambition, you know, your human, you know, innovation and appropriate slow thinking, governance, putting controls in place. That's where the good stuff comes from.
Yeah.
So yeah.
100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like that story about the pandemic there. That's funny.
Fantastic.
But yeah, definitely. I mean, need to be prepared to really stay on top of it. And then, yeah, absolutely. But I think that's a good note to end the discussion. Kate, thanks so much for joining us. And thanks
Pleasure.
For
Thank
your
you.
Great,
it was great
insights.
Chat.
Yeah. Great discussion. Thanks so much. And thank you, Rachel, as always.
Really enjoyed it. That was a fantastic chat. Thank you both.
Yeah, and thanks to our listeners. We'll catch you in the next episode.
You've been listening to the MadTech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.